Welcome to an episode of India Independent Films Podcast. This is Rahul Desai here, film critic for Film Companion. And I have with me, once again, Uday Bhatia, film critic for Mint. We are here to discuss inarguably the biggest movie weekend of the year, and as we promised. And I promised myself I wouldn't say this term, but Barbenheimer is here. And we are going to be talking about Oppenheimer and Barbie. Two of the most high-profile films of the year. We both of us watched it last week. Both of us had to write about it as well. It's been fascinating to see the discourse out there. The internet has been at its funniest and its most annoying at the same time, as usual, especially film Twitter. And it's been very entertaining to watch, as much as the films almost. We're going to be talking about Oppenheimer first. I just said Barbenheimer again. As everyone knows, this is the new Christopher Nolan movie, his first after Tenet, which released during the pandemic. Christopher Nolan, a very big deal in India, for those of you who don't know. It's probably one of the only countries where it is outturning Barbie, because it's the opposite elsewhere. Everyone's been looking forward to this film ever since it was announced. It's a biography of J. Robert Oppenheimer, who is known as the father of the atomic bomb. It's a fascinating biopic, unlike something I have seen before. I can say very confidently, I did not expect the film to unfurl the way it did in IMAX. I think most of us watched it in IMAX. We had a very interesting experience, which we'll get to soon. Uday, a few lines about the film before we get into it.
Unfortunately, I couldn't see it in IMAX because the tickets are booked through the week. I saw it at 12 o'clock at night, and so I was stumbling out at 3:30 in the morning, a bit disoriented, and immediately going back and trying to write and then giving up after an hour. So
that is not a smart thing to do.
Yeah, only I know how I managed these two reviews. It was just very weird. And a lot of fun, because these are two films that you really have to kind of figure out your feelings about, not only because there are a lot of people like ready to yell at you after you publish them, but just generally these are two filmmakers who don't go at things in straightforward ways, and we'll get into how that manifests in both these films. Oppenheimer, in the simplest terms, is the story of how J. Robert Oppenheimer, played by Cillian Murphy, makes, along with the other scientists, the first atomic bomb. From the time when he is recruited by a general played by Matt Damon, up till the time of its deployment. That story is followed almost in full. And because it's a Nolan film, there are two other timelines that are also there. One is in 1954, where hearings are being held about Oppenheimer's communist past, and they're about to revoke his security clearance. And he is not really clearing his name, but he is part of those hearings, and everyone's wondering why he won't, he won't sort of fight and defend himself. And there is a third timeline, which is in black and white, in which it's a senator's politician confirmation hearing, played by Robert Downey Jr. His name is Louis Strauss. And he was originally a supporter of Oppenheimer, but later became a rival, and in ways that become clear towards the end of the film, what happened in during Oppenheimer's time making the bomb and his security hearings in 1954, that affects the 1959 timeline. And it's quite interesting seeing Nolan do this because, you know, you have his films have a tendency to build and build and build and to build to their highest moment almost at the end. And out here, you kind of get like the biggest moment is the test of the atom bomb. And then the film still has a good hour to go after that. And that in itself threw me off because that's not something that I associate with him. The three timelines thing is, of course, very much him. But the way that the story unfolds within those was something unusual, I felt.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of the three timelines thing is something that I like the way it sort of dawns upon us while watching the film, in the sense it's a little, obviously it's a little disorienting at first. There's a black and white timeline, which is probably the latest one, which is Strauss's confirmation hearing. And then there are two color timelines, which is basically one is the conventional biopic. I think it's around 25 years or so that it follows Oppenheimer through his life and how he sort of ends up creating the bomb and a bit of the consequences after that. And then the 1954 security hearing, which is probably what I found interesting is that he's used the entire time, his usual time thing here as more, it's not so much a gimmick, I felt. I felt like you were almost seeing an emotional converging of sorts of the person, because I think the original timeline, not original, but the longest timeline where we see him actually make the bomb with his team and the government dropping into Japan, I felt like that entire part we are seeing sort of the transformation in general of a physicist, of a scientist. And I like the fact that the 1954 and the 59 hearings are basically, it's almost giving answers to questions that are being raised during that timeline at the same time. And it's, it takes a lot to sort of associate all three emotional arcs per se and the character arc in general, because you're trying to figure out why he's sort of not resisting the sort of tarnishing of his name in 1954, and you also see parts of why he became that person while the film is going on, while we are seeing the sort of the chunk of the time, the 1940s basically. And I found it very refreshing that he did something like this narratively, which is normally known for, to used to great dramatic effect or to sort of unleash a twist on us, or to even in the way he did in Dunkirk, he's using basically time to sort of expand and compress time, as per the events of war. I felt like this was a little more human and intimate. It was more psychological, and I felt like it was a big risk to take, because he also risked a lot of the audience sort of getting a little restless with, not figuring out what is going on across timelines. But I think it all, that trust that he has in his own ability, because he's written the script as well, which is also based on American Prometheus, Pulitzer winning book. I felt like that trust in his own abilities for all for us to be able to join the dots and all of it to come together as far as Oppenheimer's personality is concerned, I thought that was a big swing for the fences and, mixed results for me personally, but, it really did come together in that last one I was speaking about.
I agree with that, and I do think that it's like the first time he's using time as an emotional device rather than a narrative device. I think it's always been to push like our idea of the narrative, the way we experience it, or the plot, like in more basic terms. But this time, I think he's trying to build it to a very personal, very intimate kind of effect using those three timelines. I still I'm not quite sure how I feel about that. I think I'm going to see it again today, and I might have a different view on those three timelines. To me, it's still kind of, it felt like something that Nolan now feels that he's almost obliged to do, that if he doesn't sort of play around with time and with perspective, then his audience might think less of him. I am not sure that a linear story would not have had the same impact out here. Maybe a second viewing would kind of would change that idea of mine. I did like that he didn't keep black and white as the earliest time, but as the one where, you know, as a warning that maybe you shouldn't be seeing things in black and white, which I thought was neat. Like, the most recent timeline was the one in black and white, which was nice. What how did you feel about the film's approach to, like, the biopic, as it were? Because again, this is a very strange and, you know, it's an almost abstract film at times. Like, it has a kind of dreamlike quality, but it also has something which both of us, I think, mentioned in our reviews, that it also has a sort of chaotic quality, like almost like it's a, like, I felt like scenes were almost colliding into each other without, you know, almost without control. And I thought that was, like, really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I was a little thrown off by that, honestly. And, you know, having said that, even I plan to watch it again this week. That's not to say that, you know, I didn't entirely sort of, you know, get it when I watched it. But it was a very difficult screening last week, because the screening was supposed to, it was an IMAX screen, it was a press screening, more or less. It was supposed to start at 7, it started at 10 and ended at like 2 in the morning or something. So it was like physically already difficult before that, and the film really sort of wiped me out by the end. And that's the approach. The approach he took sort of made me sink in my seat a little while I was watching it, because it was a constant barrage. Even as you said, you know, that the scenes colliding into each other thing we have seen before, right? We've seen him make the Dark Knight series very similarly in terms of the pace, or in terms of the rhythm of storytelling. He does that. He doesn't want to let a scene really play, run its course. It always feels like he's playing around a little with the editing so that, you know, no scene has its time to breathe. And that goes against convention, at least as far as biopics are concerned. You may not go against convention in superhero films or in science fiction films, or in war films for that matter, which all he's made. But in terms of biopics, and especially something as psychological and something as chaotic as this film, it was not an approach I expected. And I guess a lot of my... I was already constantly playing catch up with what was happening, or with the style of the way the film was unfolding. And it's sort of, if you look at it from the perspective that, okay, we are seeing what Oppenheimer is seeing, and we are seeing a first person perspective, and legend has it that Nolan did write the script in first person. That's part of the publicity drops that we've been hearing about for the last 6 months. But it sort of makes sense. I'm not sure entirely what I think about the watching experience there, because, and we'll get to a few points of discourse about, you know, the criticism it's facing in very stupid criticism. We'll get to that also. But, you know, this sort of style that this scene's colliding into each other thing that you said, I really don't know what to make of it in as a narrative device, because but overall the cumulative effect it had on me watching a biopic about a physicist who is overcome by guilt and who sort of turns human a little too late in his own worldview, I feel like eventually it sort of makes sense if you look at it in hindsight. And if you find a film fascinating or if you like the film, we do have this, it's human nature to sort of justify why a difficult approach works, or what the filmmaker might have been thinking to take this particular approach, like the black and white you mentioned as well. Like I looked at it as the world moving backward rather than moving forward, you know, like the world going into the past and being sort of hit into the past by the creation of the atomic bomb, as well as the black and white thing that don't look at things in black and white, as you mentioned. So I felt like the approach that he took in terms of this very hurried, rushed, disorienting filmmaking, it did eventually have the desired effect on me. And
I had a nutcase theory about that. I feel like he wants us at some level to feel like we are inside a nuclear reaction. There are always these flashes of nature on fire that are coming in between, unexplained, like, you know, these bright rings or these sea of what look like stars and stuff and these bubbling things. And, you know, the scenes colliding into each other. And, you know, if you notice in the desert, there always seems to be like these suspended particles in the air. And they really reminded me of the radioactive ash we see in like Chernobyl and stuff like that. And I think that at a subliminal level, he wants us to kind of feel like we are inside that reaction, not only seeing the blast of the, you know, when it happens at Trinity, but like to feel like the whole film is made like that.
That's really taking method filmmaking to the next level, right?
Method reviewing.
Method reviewing, method filmmaking. It's bizarre that, I mean, I wouldn't put it past him, honestly. Like it's not even a nutcase theory so much, because it's really the sort of immersive filmmaking that Nolan keeps talking about, and people dismiss him as a snob for because of that, or a purist, or whatever you want to call him. He does take these big swings for the fences, and like so many people will have their own interpretation of why Oppenheimer was made the way it did. The way it was, and that entire sort of hallucinatory sort of experience that we go through while watching the film is as much down to the film as it is his sort of audacity to even make a film about a bomb that, you know, feels like a bomb, and it's never about the bomb only exploding. It's about what comes after, what comes before, the suspense before, the sort of consequences after. And the film itself being sort of structured like that, where even though there is a climax in the middle of the film almost, the fact that it builds up to that extraordinary sequence where they do the test in New Mexico, and the bomb, we see the explosion of the bomb, which so many people are talking about. So much comes after that, and it's, as you mentioned, you know, I didn't see that coming. It is very un-Nolan-like as well, and just the audacity to even think on those terms and trust the audience to sort of go with it, or trust the intelligence of the audience or the perceptions of the audience to figure it out or to draw their own conclusions from it. I think that's something we associate with someone like Nolan, and I do feel like he's gotten a little more, how do I put it? He's gotten a little more, he started making a little more award-centric movies in the last few years, since, say, Dunkirk, after he was accused of, you know, being too blockbustery with his science fiction films, like Inception or the Dark Knight trilogy or Interstellar, and with Dunkirk, and then Tenet, though, was like a glorified James Bond movie.
What you'd give Tenet, but yeah, Dunkirk for sure. And
You could feel like he... there are times where you can sense that he wants to be taken far more seriously than he is, or than his legacy is. And he wants to hit past the fandom that he has, and also tap the sort of the Stanley Kubrick fan clubs or the, you know, whatever, the very niche, the auteur fan clubs that we call. And that's very visible in Dunkirk and this film. I'll just treat Tenet as a bit of an anomaly. But yeah, I could see it in this film as well.
Since you're mentioning these three films, let me also ask you, these are the three films since he started working with Hoyt van Hoytema as cinematographer. And I mean, Wally Pfister had obviously an amazing collaboration with Nolan, like one of the great modern maybe director cinematographer collaborations. But I really like what Hoytema and Nolan bring up together. I think there's just I don't understand how, but it's just it's rarefied his look. He always had sleek looking films, but from Dunkirk onwards they're really striking, and some of the imagery in Oppenheimer is absolutely stunning, with that hard desert light coming through the windows, falling on these profiles. It's quite striking in a way that I think even Nolan's earlier films didn't really have.
Yeah, I mean, also the earlier films were sort of, I like the fact that you can see the evolution of an artist in a way, like not like he ever needed to evolve in, like it's more latitudinal evolution than sort of up to or down to up, because you can see that the science fiction films or the more popular films that he made early on and the trilogy that he made, you could see that after that, and as you mentioned, it sort of coincides with his collaboration with Hoytema. And you're right about like both Dunkirk as well as this film, and even parts of Tenet, which I rewatched recently, and I can still claim to have not understood. Oppenheimer for me is, till I at least watch it the second time, it's always going to be it's going to be sort of defined a little more visually than sort of viscerally or orally in my head till then, because the New Mexico parts were so distinct in the way they looked, or the way the atom bomb sort of exploding, or the test was shot, for example. The way that was shot, and there was a storm at night, and him sort of putting little tidbits of all different kinds of genres into the film. Like I saw, I like the fact that there were almost like superhero kind of Easter eggs, the way the cameos came, right? Like the way normally we see this in a lot of these Marvel and DC films, and the amount of famous people in this film just for 2-minute roles, like Rami Malek and Kenneth Branagh, and so many of them just sort of appearing and disappearing, and Casey Affleck and appearing and disappearing, and even the names dropped during the film, real names in history, like Kennedy, for example. I love the fact that it just dropped in a way that that takes the audience by surprise, and something that we are only used to about hearing in genre movies and not in biopics as such. And he has that certain level of sort of almost historical suspense in his storytelling, and he does it very well. I also like that that part where Cillian Murphy as Oppenheimer sort of at the beginning of the project, the Manhattan Project, where he's just started to take control of the entire sort of project, he is seen wearing like military uniform, and he's talking to one of his colleagues trying to convince him to join the project, and his colleagues is like, you need to look like a scientist. You need to stop looking like a soldier. And in the very next scene, we see him sort of walking down the same dusty New Mexico sort of town that is coming to life in the garb that we see him for the rest of the film, or in a very scientist, in that hat and that suit and the cigarette sort of just dangling from his lips that we come to associate him. And I love the fact that it felt like a very... it felt like a very elevated moment in a film about a scientist who's wrestling with his own self, with his own sort of moral dignity, and it just felt like someone else
I think tells him that you've become a politician, you're not a scientist,
and it's
somewhere in between, and yes, the implication that he's become maybe both a scientist and a military man rather than just the person who's making the bomb. I, as a long time Cillian Murphy fan and a super fan of Peaky Blinders, it was very gratifying to see him get the kind of role that one felt that Nolan would possibly give him one day, considering that Nolan really cannot seem to be away from Murphy for too long, and in this it's perfect. I'm so glad it's not Benedict Cumberbatch, because I think had this project happened a few years earlier, that would have been the casting, and he's fantastic, because I don't think he lets on the way that some people who have been complaining in the film would like him to sort of let on to the feelings of Oppenheimer. He keeps it complicated. You can see how he becomes like slightly obsessed with the idea of the bomb, and he starts sort of canvassing for it because he gets excited. This is his work. It would be his greatest achievement. And right when it's too late, he starts wondering what he's done. And it's great, because it's not like there's this huge difference in the way he's acting from when he's pushing for the bomb and when he's suddenly regretting his whole life. It's just the subtle things, but it's amazing. I loved his performance. I thought he was great.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because you can't really see the transformation, right? Like normally you see, especially if there are three timelines, and in one of them he's not even defending himself. In the other, he's not even there. It's about like Lewis Strauss and how Lewis Strauss sort of led the resistance against him and sort of almost duped him out of his reputation and name. And the fact that you can't even see the transformation is a testament to his acting, because for me, the soul of Oppenheimer is basically Cillian Murphy as an actor managing to pull off the arc of a man who is basically so defined by his roots, his past, because he's a Jewish scientist also. And he did not have a good time in Europe working as a scientist. And he wanted to come back to America and make nuclear physics and make sort of theoretical physics there a big deal, because America wasn't known for it then. And then getting caught up in you could almost see that childlike pride in himself. The fact that he's become so important, the military needs him, the government needs him, and everything rests on him. Like America rests on him. You could see it in Cillian Murphy's performance without him really beating his chest about it. You could see it in his eyes, the way, or his very sort of his gait, or the way he carries himself through particular scenes in the film. The fact that, you know, like, okay, nobody considered us scientists important enough till now. Now they need us. And now they need us during the biggest world war, you know, humankind has ever seen. And I am at the center of it. You can almost see the hubris in the way he goes about performing particular scenes, but it's not like the kind of arrogance you tend to see in biopics. You don't see it in the way he in the kind of things he says or in the dialogue he says. He's not written in a way that suggests very literally that, okay, he finally feels wanted and he finally feels like he's going to prove himself and prove his genius without caring about the consequences of what his work may bring down the future. And when he does realize it, it happens in that very famous scene by now. And it's not even like he realizes it then. It's already sort of bleeding into him by then. There is no real segue into the new Oppenheimer that we see, who then starts sort of becoming an advocate for the opposite of what his bomb stood for during the war. I love the fact that, you know, his performance lets us sort of pick at the subtext and sort of interpret it in our own way. And a lot of things are intangible in that performance, and it's just so physical, and it is so it's very intense, and sort of you can see that it's taking a physical toll on Cillian himself while he's acting in it. But I like that we can sort of shape the story out of his acting.
Let's talk about the this infamous scene, since just in case we have any listeners from outside India or people who didn't see it in the hall and are seeing it months later and perhaps get to see an unedited version. So what happens is Oppenheimer is having sex with the Jean Tatlock, this woman communist whom he meets at like one of their gatherings, and he has a thing for Communist Party women, fiery women anyways, and so he has an affair with her, and we see them in bed, and after they have sex, she kind of gets up and goes to his bookshelf, and she picks up the Gita, and she comes back, and she's sort of sitting on him, as it were, and he reads he recites from it as she's as she's holding the book, and he says, "I am become death, destroyer of worlds," which is of course what he is said to have uttered later when he realizes his thing, which is I think a fun way of introducing this line that everybody knew would come at some point in the film. Mm-hmm. Obviously some people don't find it as much fun, but what I was really thrown by was this later scene after another of their trysts, where he is sitting nude in a chair and she is sitting in another chair with this sort of elegant black dress on. And I was like, that is so strange. What a weird choice by Nolan. I mean, why would she change that to, you know, why not just throw on a blanket? Why wear this kind of sort of rather chic looking black dress? It's so weird. I mean, that was I was just like, this is a strange scene. And then when I get home, I see people outraging that the censor board has actually fashioned a CG dress and put it on Florence Pugh so that to do us a favor, almost, so that we don't miss the plot. But, you know, our modesty is not outraged. Did you figure out while you were watching it that was a censor addition?
So it's funny because like Ishita, who was obviously watching it with and also a film critic, she was like, I don't think that dress is real. I was like, how can it not be real? Why would she be? Why would they make like so many possibilities were going through my head at that point, because I had heard about the fact that there might be nudity in the film before watching it. It is R-rated. So I was like, no, it can't be this scene. Maybe it's the scene where she's riding him and she's uttering passages from the Bhagavad Gita, and maybe there we see all of her, and maybe that was cut, which it also was to an extent.
That's what I thought, yeah.
I just expected the center board to be like the usual nonsensical cells and put blurs. Like, just put like that very awkward, chunky blur that they normally do for all nudity in films that are shown in India. And I didn't expect them to go through the effort of actually making a black dress. And when I found out data, I'm like, oh my God. First of all, the irony of like actually creating a VFX dress for a Nolan film during like a post
quite reasonably good dress to like, not that we are like very fashion centric, but you know, I mean, it fooled me for sure. And it's insane. I mean, that's just so weird. I don't know if it's worse, frankly, if they had blurred it or they put this dress. I really don't know.
I'm just imagining a conversation they might have had with Nolan, saying, listen, we're either going to cut the scene or we'll like put something, or if you want, we'll put a like something CGI. So he must have might have just directed them to put like a CGI dress, because blurring the scene might have just been more distracting. And this this didn't really, like, it didn't make me jump up in my seat, but I was pretty amused when I found out later, because I was just imagining the possibilities that went down, or the conversations they had with Universal Pictures saying, okay, look, we are in India, we need to do something about this scene. And I wonder what that exchange of emails might have looked like. But
you
yeah,
think Nolan very designed Indian the dress once this, if the censor board spoke with him?
I think he might have just sort of assigned that to one of his assistant directors, saying, listen, I can't, I'm going to explode if I deal with these Indians anymore. And he might have just done that, because dress just looked like one of those satin dresses.
I mean, God knows we have freaked Christopher Nolan now out on a bunch of occasions. So I think he might be a little scared of India anyways. You'll obviously remember the time when he came to Bombay and everyone treated him just like as if an alien had landed in their midst and things went slightly out of hand. I'm pretty sure that he is a little wary of this country and would just like to keep it at an arm's length and not. Though, of course, using the Gita in a sex scene is probably not the way to distract from, you know, interest from India. But, you know, lesson learned, I guess.
I immediately, when I saw the Gita scene, I'm like, oh, shit, this is going to cause a shit fest here. I was almost face-palming myself, saying, Nolan, what have you done? And that says so much about how we've been conditioned in the last few years to think, saying, oh God, of course the government's going to go after this now. But yeah, obviously the film itself, I wanted to ask, what do you think about the discourse, that nonsensical discourse about sort of why they didn't show the Japanese suffering after the bomb is dropped?
I think it's ridiculous and someone put this very well, and I wish I'd put it myself that way. I thought that the film very deliberately keeps Japan and the Japanese as abstractions almost in the film until the point where it becomes real and nothing can happen, because you can see them making decisions almost as if, you know, Japan is they're not real, like, it's not a moral comment. It's just probably the way it was, because you can imagine both a general doing that and a scientist doing that for different reasons. And I think that is very true. And the moment when it becomes too real to look at in the abstract is also when Oppenheimer's trajectory changes. And I think that I don't see how including Japan or the Japanese voice, quote unquote, in this film would have made it any more clearer what the film thinks of Oppenheimer and of the bomb, and whether it thinks that, you know, it was a good thing or not, or whether even Oppenheimer thought that it was a good thing. I've seen some people who are writing like these whole threads, and then at the end they say that, oh, you know, I haven't seen the film, or they're almost reviewing the film, they're saying that, oh yeah, I haven't actually seen the film, I'm just talking about Oppenheimer. I would like to suggest that movies are wasted on such people, and they should maybe just refrain from that, or at least fiction films are wasted on such people, and they might stick to documentaries, and even those may be wasted on them.
Yeah, like a lot of science people sort of jumping onto the bandwagon also, just because obviously they feel represented, and also they feel this moral responsibility to talk about probably the most famous scientist of all time. So, or the most infamous scientist. So it's just, I don't know. I don't see the point of really getting into that discourse, because first of all, it is whether like the narratively also, it is from the perspective of a man who wants to sort of, who basically also of course, it's from his perspective, but secondly, it's also, it shows a very flawed, broken, a man who's not very certain of himself for a big part of the film, or a big part of his own life, till, you know, those abstractions become real, how you put it, until it's almost too late, and when he realizes that he's set a chain of events that might destroy the future of the world, or that is just sort of consuming the world. So it is.
It's the ending is just him possibly having destroyed the whole world. But you know, obviously the film is not condemning him enough. It's just that he is like the most dangerous person in the history of mankind. Otherwise it's like a white guilt or whatever label people want to put on it. It just doesn't seem worthwhile even getting into this. I wasn't very taken by the two big roles for women in the film, I hate to agree with some of the people who are outraging about that, because they're in it for different reasons, that a woman doesn't speak in the first 20 minutes or whatever, which is just the most nonsense ever. But I didn't get much out of either of the roles or the performances, really. The whole point of the Florence Pugh flashback was lost on me to some extent, and Emily Blunt, apart from this one scene, I found her performance really one note and not very interesting. What did you feel about the characters and these two performances?
I mean, I see the way the biopic itself is constructed, I just felt like it felt like flashes of a life, right, rather than the life itself. It felt like a lot of things in the film were phases and were flawed parts of what how we perceive a man like him, who is like openly a womanizer, who is openly notoriously sort of, dating multiple women at a time. It just felt like more of a concept. So yeah, you may be right about that, because I didn't think much of Florence Pugh's role or performance, because I thought because her role was a little too short, I felt like she was trying to overdo that very mysterious husky woman on the side, the sort of mistress almost, and to play this mysterious woman who a man of science is fascinated by, a communist, and who also has mental health issues. So I felt like she's overdoing that a little. I didn't mind Emily Blunt, but I did like one particular scene, one terrific scene where he breaks down after Florence Pugh's suicide, after hearing about it. And he breaks down and he wants sympathy from his wife, the ridiculousness of it. And she tells him, you don't get to sin and also have us sort of feel bad for you. So that was a very effective scene in context of the film, in context of his personality. That was probably the only scene in which Emily Blunt really stood out, because I'm not a big fan of her, going all like girl boss towards the end of the film and standing up to detractors of Oppenheimer or betrayers of Oppenheimer in court itself, where she has this moment and she sort of almost fights for him because he hasn't fought so far. Those are crowd-pleasing moments, but I love this particular scene that I mentioned, because for me, it went a long way in sort of unclogging my reading of his character, or unclogging my reading of how Nolan wants to present Oppenheimer in this film. And it's very much as a man who's come to terms with his sins a little too late. And the fact that he is a genius, and the fact that he's wanted to prove himself for so long, but got lost by that entire sense of patriotism. Being a leftist, he acted like a right-wing sort of American for a long time, being seduced by sort of the government and Matt Damon's character, who sort of shows belief in him to end the war. But I like the fact that isolated scenes like that went a long way in sort of in at least opening him up a little as a more accessible, you know, movie character.
Yeah, I mean, I think again, I'd like to kind of see it without, yeah, you know, see what the thing. I do like the idea of like Nolan boiling down the atomic bomb to something, to like these very, very human feelings, like trying, you know, like saying that maybe in his own life, these were like the, you know, the crises that were going on even as these larger crises were unfolding. And it doesn't always have to make sense, but all these things are mixed up in everyone's life. And it's just that some people are doing history changing work at that same time. And I think he always kind of, Nolan in this film, and specifically really only in this film, I feel, because it's his least plotted film in a way. It's the one that is most open to like random human behavior and, you know, stuff that doesn't make sense. Otherwise, in Nolan's films, things usually do have like a cause and effect kind of thing. And out here, there's a kind of randomness to stuff, like things don't always make sense. I think that quality to me is very intriguing, and in his relationships, that certainly does come through.
I mean, the funny part is this is what he normally gets criticized for, doesn't he? Because he hides behind the plot, or at least it's perceived that he hides behind the plot and his narrative genius and his gimmickry and his, you know, overcooking that he usually does. And then he doesn't have the responsibility of explaining a human being as much, because there's so much else in the film, either visually or narratively. But here, there's no escape from that. And I love the fact that he confronts it sort of head on and saying that even a human story, even human nature can very much resemble the kind of films that I've been making so far. And all of the films I've been making maybe have their seed in some the randomness of human nature. And the fact that he cannot escape that in this film and does not even want to escape it is nice. And I like how you put it, that, you know, there's a randomness to it that that we don't often see in a lot of his films. We see it as part of a twist. We see it as part of like a revelation or a conflict. We don't see an entire life like this, and we don't see such less plot and so much sort of humanity, whether it's naked or ugly or pretty or genius or whatever it is. And that's why it's a very interesting project for him to take, especially after something as plot heavy as Tenet. That's the reason I've been looking forward to watching it again, now that I'm very familiar with the identity of the people in the film, the identity of what sort of Oppenheimer is or who he is. It'll be very interesting to see where this film lands in terms of his filmography overall so far. What do you think there?
I think it feels like it feels different from him.
Yeah.
I wonder where it'll lead. It may just be that it's like, you know, that it's one film in a different direction, and then it might be, you know, a little more of what we expect. I mean, were expecting from Nolan earlier. Fincher just made Mank, but then his next film sounds like a very Fincher-esque kind of serial killer project and all that. So it might just go, you know, back in the opposite direction. And but it did feel like something new for me. I think it would probably be, I don't know, top three Nolan personal. I mean, maybe with Inception and Dunkirk, I really did like it. But, you know, of course, those keep changing. And that might even change by my next viewing of the film. So, it was really quite something. Like, even at 3 hours and 10 minutes, you don't really feel like you've... I mean, it's not a film that waits at all. It's not a film that has any let up through its whole running time, and you feel like you run a marathon by the end.
Yeah, and the best part is there's so much talking in the film, which is again something that is normally accused of. There's so much sort of internal drama, but like sort of behind closed doors drama that's happening, whether in courtrooms or whether in small offices or whether in like in sort of in New Mexico when they're planning to assemble the bomb. There's so much talking happening, but not a lot of it is exposition. A lot of it is just human sort of trying to figure out their place in history and trying to figure out how to get out from a particular situation or how to sort of accomplish something. And I like that he doesn't care about whether we understand what they're saying or not there. Like, there's a lot of shit that they say that, you know, if you don't read up about Oppenheimer before going in, you might not get, but that's fine. And because you eventually, it's like the smoke dissipates and you see a shape, you see the shape of a sort of life that he's trying to convey. And it'll be interesting to see, same for me, because it'll be interesting to see how I feel about it also after the second time, which I really hope to see soon, because it was very hallucinatory the first time. And it's not an experience I'll forget anytime soon. Before I put any adjectives to it, whether positive or negative, but yeah, very interesting experience. Is there anything else? Should we move to Barbie?
No, let's segue smoothly to Barbie.
Yeah, it's the smoothest segue in modern cinema. As we know, Greta Gerwig's Barbie, which is probably arguably the biggest film of the year so far. And Margot Robbie, again, she seems to be everywhere these days. You know, rightfully so. She is Barbie in this film. And there's, of course, Ryan Gosling as Ken. Are there a few lines about the film before we like talk about it?
I mean, in its most basic sense, it's sort of the Truman Show to start off with.
Yeah.
She's living Barbie, played by Margot Robbie's living in Barbie land. There is, it's like this paradise. She, nothing is real, nothing to get worried about. All her friends are also Barbie. They all have defined roles. One is president, one's a doctor, one's a writer. The Kens aren't defined at all because they only have any meaning in their relationship towards Barbie. And so they have to kind of defer to the Barbies. And it's sort of this benign, happy matriarchy. Everything's going fine, except one day she has existential dread. And we are told that this is because an owner who has her in the real world is transferring some of these bad vibes to her. And so she is sent to look for this person so that she can confront them and find out why she is dreading reality and why her feet are flat and why she might be aging. And so she and Ken, that's Ryan Gosling's Ken, go to the real world, California, and there basically they find not only the owner but also the company that makes Barbies, which is Mattel.
That's a nice sort of two-liner about Barbie. And did you, I mean, I just have a few questions before we get into it, but how much of the discourse leading up to Barbie and Greta Gerwig's sort of take on it, and because it was impossible to ignore, how much of that sort of takes a toll on how we watch the film, or what you thought about this film? Because I think a lot of us did have similar views about the film, you know, like not too deep but enjoyable. I was just curious to know, because it was impossible to ignore, and we did have to watch Oppenheimer first, and by then, you know, the Barbie sort of discourse had almost blown up by then. So
yeah, I can very much understand where the Barbie, like this kind of exuberant Barbie discourse came from, because if you pair it against Oppenheimer and Nolan's fan base, traditionally male, traditionally nerds, quite dismissive towards people who don't quote unquote get him, this would seem like the polar opposite of that kind of film, a film that's made for them. And it was a lot. I mean, I think, frankly, they did a great job with the marketing. They did a tremendous job with it, because somehow they managed to make it feel organic, but it's obviously not organic, because it's being backed by a huge studio and a lot of money goes into that and everything. But it had this kind of the promotions are so smart, and Robbie and Ryan Gosling were so smart in the way that they promoted it, and they made it seem so personal to them. And I do believe that it was, because both of them are fantastic in the film.
Yeah.
And I think they created something emotional in the promotions, which kind of diverted from the fact that, you know, this is just a huge movie studio doing promotions as usual. They made it seem like something better than that, almost, which is, quite a feat. But, you know, in the sense that the film also, I guess, does something on that level.
Yeah.
It is, for me at least, I thought it was very organic feeling. It was a feat of imagination. I really liked the look of it. I liked the practical effects that went into it. I liked its kind of sweetness. It had this sort of goofiness to it, which I thought was very appealing. But at some level, also, there is this kind of calculated nature to its subversiveness that kind of stops it from being truly subversive. And I think it just, up till the point at which you're looking at the movie as something that's truly subversive, I think I quite liked it. I thought that it was quite an individual look. But beyond that, I don't think it really worked for me.
There's that handmade quality we just noticed about. We are just seeing the behind the scenes, some clips of it, and how... Yeah. How sort of Greta Gerwig shot the scenes where Barbie has to transition into the real world, basically reach the real world, and the sort of journey she has to take, and basically four different environments, and how they shot it, which reminded me very much of the film Hugo, and how we saw sort of George Méliès' story come to life there, and the kind of techniques, very old school techniques that they used to shoot it.
Absolutely. What Wes Anderson did in Grand Budapest Hotel, or some of his other films, with those very fairy tale like almost backdrops and very seamlessly blended with the actors.
Dissonance is always very disarming, because, you know, we are supposed to be in on the joke, and we're supposed to be sort of getting or really enjoying the DIY-ness of such filmmaking, which is I really like the world building here, as you said. I really enjoyed a lot of the one-liners. I actually was quite disarmed even by the way they went about the plotting. If you have to find the real human, of course, a lot of it is Truman Show and the same sort of concept behind it. The same sort of ideology about a take on consumerism, on feminism, on the modern world. But the fact that you have to find the human who's playing with you, and then you bring that human back and then turn it into a bit of a spoof, but at the same time, have these monologues where you state out the most obvious things ever, that, you know, basically is also... A take on how social media is so literal about their about their opinions, about their so almost militant about a lot of their observations about the world and how woke they are, and how the modern world is sort of steeped in contradictions. So I really like the fact that they didn't take the entire plotting part too seriously and stuck to a particular tone. But I'd have to agree where, as far as the subversiveness is concerned, because of course Mattel people, you know, they want to be known as a good sport, and they are, their executives led by Will Ferrell, who's the CEO of the company, are introduced as absolute goofballs and patriarchal idiots. And, you know, these corporate people who sell female agency very consciously. But, you know, you'd have to question how the film is not very different from that. And I guess the film is okay with doing that and okay with being part of both the problem and the solution. And I found that subversiveness a bit too self-aware, a bit too like over-clever and wink-wink about it. And I guess it depends on our expectations or what we go into Barbie, what we sort of go into the film hoping to expect from it. Because a lot of people who just go in hoping to enjoy the film are really taking it at as face value and enjoying the heck out of the film, which is why it's earning a shitload of money. And I think a lot of different kind of people, or a lot of us, especially a lot of us who are doing the Barbenheimer double bill, or a lot of men for that matter, are going into the film hoping to look for deeper meaning, hoping to look for sort of subversiveness, but sold on a different level. And I wonder how much of our expectations you know, affect that viewing experience, or even shape our viewing experience for that matter. Which is why even I thought it was, I mean, it was, it's a very sort of smart film in its own right, but it also knows it's being very smart, and it knows exactly what buttons to push, what monologues to give, what actors to sort of have as, you know, delivering throwaway lines and puns and one-liners. And Ryan Gosling is great fun, and Margot Robbie is very good at what she does. But yeah, I it's not something that I will remember as this, you know, path-breaking, earth-shattering film about a particular movement that has followed itself. Not really. Like, it's a fun film, but that's about it, I guess.
I agree with this idea that, you know, it's so thought through. Like, I would say that it's very careful in its its humor, and it almost seems to anticipate what a criticism of a particular joke or scene might be, and then address it within that scene itself. Yeah. And this is something that is not new, I think, in films now. You do see this kind of self-consciousness anyways. And like, for example, in the scene where the narrator interjects during that scene where they're saying that, you know, that Barbie's supposed to look pretty, and then the narrator interjects and says that, you know, casting Margot Robbie isn't the ideal way to, you know, talk about unrealistic body expectations, it's just, I mean, it's funny, and I may be totally in a minority out here, because the scene played very well in the theater, and it got a huge laugh, and I see people on Twitter really liking it also. To me, it felt almost like a film looking at itself saying, oh, you know, before someone accuses us of casting this gorgeous actor in the lead, we're going to make it into a joke so no one can, no one can criticize us. Same thing about that white savior Barbie that Sasha says in another scene. But Barbie immediately says that, oh, you know, but this is your mother's reasoning, I'm just repeating it. And it's, I mean, who is going to take white savior Barbie seriously anyways?
It's not even something that needs defending. It's just like a funny little aside and you just move on from that. But the fact that she had to actually explain that, oh no, you know, it's a person of color and I have taken their reasoning and I'm talking about it. It just seems very self-conscious and very, you know, defensive. And I don't know, I guess I wanted it to cut loose a little bit. I feel a little bit dangerous. It just felt a bit safe to me.
So I saw a very interesting tweet today that addresses some of our feelings about this also. It is nice to see the other side also, because I think it's a tweet by a film critic based in the West. And she says that it feels like all the complaints about Barbie's feminism being basic ignore how her journey intentionally parallels a girl's growth from childhood to adolescence and her first awareness of social inequities because she's purposely modeled after kids because she's a kid's toy. I actually found this quite interesting. There is one way of putting it and saying that of course the subversiveness was basic and of course the feminism was on the nose, and then you make a film about a toy and say of course it's on the nose, we know we are flawed. And at least us calling ourselves flawed makes it more fun, and which is what we've been talking about. So what do you think about this particular line of reasoning? Because I found it very fascinating that, because of course we see stereotypical Barbie, who is Margot Robbie in this film, waking up to the patriarchy in the real world and then waking up to all these monologues and this very, the basicness of how the world is and sort of Ken getting patriarchy back into Barbie land and then threatening to take charge, and which is basically 101, right? And then her equating it to say a girl's growth from childhood to adolescence, it's not a bad theory.
It's not a bad theory. I think that the film is the film's level of subversion, I think, matches pretty much the tone of the film. I think the film is tonally very, very even. I don't think everything is in, you know, everything is kind of in concert with the other elements. There is this slightly sweet, goofy quality to the whole film. I think maybe making it more acidic or making it more, sort of dangerous might have messed with that tone. So it's possible that they found the exact correct balance of sort of satire for the tone that they were going for, because to me it feels like very much like a very consistent tone through the whole film. It's just that after a while I kind of felt like, the film just didn't really have something pulling me in after a while. Like, it was just pleasant, and it was, of course, consistently funny. But that was about it, really. I wasn't as emotionally invested as I wanted to be. But, a lot of people were, or a lot of people have said that they are. So, again, maybe another viewing of the film might change my mind towards it.
Yeah, a lot of it, and I mentioned this in my piece also, that it reminded me a lot of these sort of Lego Batman movie and the Lego movies that are made that are absolute send-off to the superhero films. But they are also superhero films on their own by parading superhero films. And I wonder if we hadn't seen something like Across the Spider-Verse or the Spider-Verse, the two films, if we hadn't seen how a film like this, in this tone, being self-aware and being subversive, but also being safe at the same time, might have occurred to us. Because I feel like a lot of the way I'm viewing this genre, where it's satire and it's also self-referential and almost self-parody in a way, but also being real at the same time. A lot of this genre now for me is defined by that particular franchise films and how they do it. Sure, there's it's more serious, it's more poignant, and it says a lot more, it's more complex. And Barbie doesn't really aspire to be that complex. But that's really the, for me, that was the pinnacle of this kind of storytelling, where you want to actually send off a particular genre that has made millions and billions, and you want to particularly send off a toy company that you are basically, you know, you're basically a part of. And at the same time, you also want to be a film in your own right. And I don't think there are many modern films that do it as well as those animated films.
I do wish that they had gone a little further in there, like, and become an all-out musical. Because the one time that the film does it, which is the I'm Just Ken number, is fantastic. That's like really good. That whole sequence I thought was like it just every bit of it was really funny, really eye-catching. Simu Liu is terrible, but Gosling makes up for it. Why is Simu Liu? I didn't really I didn't watch Shang-Chi, so I haven't seen his big film, and I haven't seen him before in anything really, I think. Man, he's terrible out here. He's like a charisma black hole. He's not good.
I'm quite amused by the reactions to him now, because like I didn't even barely notice him watching the film, and I was like, of course, you know, he's there in the film because it's part of the in joke that there's a Asian Ken, and they're going to be there's a diversity of Ken just as there's a diversity of Barbies. But yeah, as far because he is a fairly big name, and it is a very weird performance, or maybe a weirdly directed performance.
I don't think so. I think Gerwig is pretty good at getting performances out of people. I don't think anyone else in the film has suffered. It's just Liu. I was fine with all the other performances, pretty much. Yeah, anyways, but I do wish that they had kind of really gone for the song and dance a little more, because I thought the one time when they really commit to it, which was I'm Just Ken, I thought the film really takes off. And it's kind of towards the end, and it's a really good time for that number to come. Like it really picks up the energy and all. I thought that really worked for me.
Like, I like the fact that in that I'm Just Ken and the entire musical number and the way Ryan Gosling does it, I like that he's also aware of the fact that he's threatening to hijack the narrative, that like most men do in films like this, by making it about themselves and the self-pity and the man-childness of it all. And he's doing it in such a way, and the film is going along with him, giving him a very long sort of musical number and absolutely forgetting about the Barbies that are watching from far away, like watching all the Kens like go nuts themselves and hijacking the film, but also sort of destroying themselves at the same time. I like that the film went with that little very amusing conceit where, you know, the men sort of just steal the limelight, but also get blinded by it so much that they just like are in self-destructive mode after that. And and I feel like Ryan Gosling is very aware of the fact that the film has forgotten or pretends to forget about the Barbies at that point.
I love him in the scenes with Robbie, because he's so he defers to her as an actor also. Like Ken is obviously desperate for her attention, but Gosling plays that so well. He gives her the center stage in the scene. She's, you know, like the way he looks at her, everyone else wants to look at her also, because, you know, there's just this sort of awe in his eyes. And it's just he because the way he shines the focus onto her, that really just explains the character right there. It's a really funny performance, but it's also kind of touching, because he is sort of creating the condition for her to be like the sort of overwhelming star of this film. I thought that was really nice. And Robbie is I thought very, very good in the role. I thought she's really, really funny, and she's also, I think she does one thing well, in which though the film can appear as self-aware at times, I don't think her performance comes across as a self-aware performance, which could have been a bit irritating. Amy Schumer was planning to, the one who was in talks to make this film way before Gerwig took it on. I think if, you know, if she had made it or if she had played, that would have been, even the performances would have been a lot more self-aware, and that kind of, you know, that gets annoying as an audience member. I thought Robbie really did well to avoid that.
Yeah, also it would have been so easy to play into the entire sort of conceit of her casting, right? Like, because she is, she's almost been cursed with her looks for the longest time, even though she's acted in some of the best director's film of our generation. I don't think she's taken as seriously as she wants to as an actress. Over the last 5 or 6 years, ever since she's been like getting author-backed roles one after another, and she's still, in terms of like her acting abilities and her artistic talent, for some reason I feel like there's always this this thing that maybe she is too beautiful for to be taken as a like a real actor, and there's always this perception about very good looking actors, whether it be Brad Pitt, whether it be like Tom Cruise, or whether it be her, and they've all shown that they can act, and it is just perception. And I like the fact that she might have been cast exactly for that reason, and the arc of Barbie is more or less the same, because stereotypical Barbie wants to break out of that stereotype and be taken seriously by the end, wants to be human and wants to be flawed, and maybe less perfect. So I guess it would have been really easy to play along with that and be very, you know, as self-aware as the film about that. But Margot Robbie, I've grown to really admire in the last few years, especially because I think Babylon is streaming now on Amazon Prime. And, you know, for those of you who haven't watched it, I really think it is, it's a phenomenal, first of all, like cinematic experience. It's a fascinating film and a fascinating lead performance by Margot Robbie, who really gives it her all. And I'm shocked that it sort of, that film really wasn't part of more part of our discourse like last year or this year, or award, because it was ignored by the awards as well, and Damien Chazelle's film basically. And I feel like she's one of the foremost sort of you know, the balances of star power and I guess you know risk taking as far as, you know, actors under 40 or under 35 are concerned these days, because we've been seeing her for quite a while and I don't think she's given really a bad performance. And I think Barbie is elevated because of her, and she's great fun. Like, she's not really playing into the film, because even Ryan Gosling, you can see that he has great comic timing, and he knows that, and he uses it to great effect here. But Margot Robbie does a lot more than that, because there are some very oddly moving moments towards the end of the film when she has these sort of human flashes about what it might feel like to be human and how human sort of memories work. And I feel like Robbie made it more convincing.
Yeah, those montages were interesting. I actually don't know how I feel about them. My initial thought was that these seem maybe overly sentimental and very much playing to, you know, to the gallery. And now I think that maybe not. And I think it was actually quite touching. But I'm still kind of mulling over that. But again, a very interesting directorial idea, and I like Gerwig as a director. I think I think Little Women still is my favorite of hers, because of how she approached that text. But she continues to be a really interesting director. I was very disappointed to learn that she's now going to apparently make like 2 Narnia films. Because why would you want to go into a franchise after you've basically earned yourself the power to do, you know, whatever you want? You've made that huge opening that allows you to make like
a film for yourself, choose your cast, choose your subject. And of course, she could not have known how Barbie would have opened, but I mean, I'm not going to watch a Narnia film. And even if it's Greta Gerwig, who cares? The same way as I'm not going to watch Barry Jenkins' Lion King, because again, who cares?
Yeah.
It's just sad. I mean, there are only a few directors who I care about now to avoid franchises. And it's dispiriting when they go in that direction.
Yeah, and I don't like the fact that a lot of these directors who come up through, you know, sort of independent routes or critical acclaim or just the hard way are almost reverential towards these big budget sort of franchises that they eventually get to make. And all of them sound like they've always wanted to make it then. Like, I always wanted to make a Marvel film or a Bond movie or a Narnia movie or you know, whatever you... I always wanted to do something. It'll be fun to do something like this. Oh, you didn't. Like, you just, it changed. Like, things change. And it's always like a little dispiriting because you see indie directors get sort of swallowed by the studio system. Very systematic. You see it like in front of your eyes. And it is sad to see things like that or decisions like that made. And I was always almost a little wary about Barbie. Though I think she did a fairly good job about making a blockbuster look independent, as you said, and still making it look a little more organic and defying the origins of the film or the product itself. And she really stamped her voice onto a film like this, which you may not have thought is possible with an IP like Barbie. But there you go. Like, if she's going to make a film, and they all say that, yeah, it was my childhood dream too, because I love the Narnia books, or I love the Black Panther books, I love these books, I love. But that's the thing. Like, it's just at some point it gets a little dispiriting because they, as you said, there are only a few directors who really have a voice and who really can change the shape of new modern filmmaking over the next 10 or 20 years, and Gerwig is one of them. And I just hope like maybe she comes back on track or something, or maybe something happens. I don't know.
I think that's pretty much it for Barbie. But do you want to drop a word about Bawal since you wrote about it? I saw it, but luckily I didn't have to write about it. Good fun though, good film, a lot of interesting ideas.
Don't take it like this, people are going to take you seriously. Like, they don't, nobody gets irony these days, that's the whole point.
I saw it as, believe it or not, a palate cleanser between the two films, after Oppenheimer and before Barbie. It did not cleanse my palate, but... what is it like seeing it in a hall and having to write about that? I read a bunch of very irritated sounding reviews, yours included.
Yeah, I love that it brings out like reviewers to get really funny in their reviews, but I'm really tired of that myself personally. And yeah. I was pretty shocked to be part, like to watch it on a big screen, because I was of the belief that I had to make an Oppenheimer screening after that, and the Oppenheimer screening was delayed by 3 hours. So to sort of trek to town after that screening in the suburbs, and this screening, Bawal, as we know, it's a streaming release, but they did have a press screening that was in theaters, and it was doubly annoying because of that, because the flaws are doubly amplified on the big screen, unfortunately, as cliched as it sounds. And it is ridiculous that you can make a film like this and then put it all down to saying that, you know, you can love these days is a complicated emotion. Just for those who are even interested or those who haven't switched off already, Bawal is basically about a couple arranged marriage. They are on a belated honeymoon to Europe because the guy thinks he can sort of teach his students online about World War II from Europe, which let's not get into that. And the film ends up comparing the Holocaust to their marriage and to love in general. because the guy learns to, because the couple learn to appreciate each other and love each other once they realize what atrocities the Jews went through during the Holocaust and during World War II. And this is the real premise in 2023. And I'm shocked that it didn't get all-round bad reviews. It's gotten, in fact, quite a few decent reviews saying that, you know, at least it had the audacity to do something like this, even if the execution wasn't great. And I'm inclined to judge that. Like, I really am. I'm sorry. But
the audacity to be, like, really, really stupid. I feel like I can't even be that offended by this film because it is so dumb. It is just so stupid. At an idea level, it's so stupid that it kind of dulls my sense of outrage that they can. And I feel like it's I think that's what saved the film, is that it's really just too stupid to have that kind of sustain the kind of outrage that would last for a long time.
No, I
how
agree
anyone
with you.
Can like it is beyond me. That is, of course, India and its films and its viewers.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think like a younger version of me, which is to say 4 or 5 years ago, might have been really offended by it and written a very angry review. But now I found a new tone, which is sarcasm in my reviews and about bad films, at least. I am no more angry. I'm just resigned. And I guess that's the stage you reach with films like this that are, as you said, too dumb to be taken seriously or too dumb to be offensive or too dumb to even cause. I'm actually quite surprised with the fact that it's gone viral, you know, like all the stupid dialogues from the film, because these are people who clearly have not watched enough of Hindi cinema and they suddenly pick out a line from a dumb Hindi film and say, oh God, what is Bollywood doing? But they've been doing this for a while. Don't wake up now. I am angry towards them also. Like, why are you even making this film go viral? This is every week for us. And this is, that's not to say Bollywood is doing stupid shit like this, but you're not, like, it's not shocking anymore. It's just part of every week. It's like going to office and coming, like breathing. And just watching a dumb Varun Dhawan character say stupid things, and you know, like, it's not shocking anymore. We are not supposed to be offended by it. We are just supposed to sort of just like be resigned to the fact that it's not going to change, and nothing, whatever we say, is not going to make a difference in the long run, because there have been quite a few viewers who are defending this film for some reason. I can't imagine why. But yeah,
some very famous directors
as well,
and other people who ought to know better. Yeah, it's just I could hardly watch it, and I didn't even have to watch it, you know, and it was just, I mean, it was just terrible. So yeah.
And so we'll end the podcast on that very optimistic note. We did discuss two of the biggest films of the year so far, Barbie and Oppenheimer. Doing billions at the box office. Good for everyone. Good for everyone who's enjoying it. And we hope to watch it again, and do write in about your opinions about the film. And the best part is, they have been very divisive opinions. They have all sorts of opinions. So it's just not like it's all praise or all madness and all, like, all hail Christopher Nolan. There are a lot of detractors as well. And it's always interesting to hear. The internet discourse has been fascinating. Do write into us if you have any suggestions or any opinions to share. And of course, we did talk about Bawal. We will act like we did not. And we will be back soon with, I guess, a Karan Johar film soon. He's making a film after a long time. And his film, Rocky Rani, what is the Ki Prem Kahani, is releasing this week. I've known it as Rocky and Rani for so long. It stars Alia Bhatt, Ranveer Singh. We'll hopefully be reviewing it and talking about it. Till then, you know, take care. See you soon. Enjoy your time at the movies till it lasts. You're not going to get a weekend like this again. You heard it first year. It's going to be a long time coming. Maybe Christmas, maybe next year. So enjoy the week and stay safe.